Abraham Lincoln delivered 4 world-changing speeches over 150 years ago, which, if we consider them carefully, can give us incredible guidance in America's path forward. We are a house divided, but thankfully, there's a solution to our greatest division since the 19th century. Let's talk about it today in episode 56. I'm Blake Watson, and this is We the Free. One of the best ways you can help our show, other than by sharing today's episode, is by picking up some We the Free merch at wethefreeshow.com. You can be the salt and light you were meant to be by wearing the salt and light shirt, or by sipping your coffee from the salt and light mug. Or you can sport the God Bless America shirt and the We the Free crest tee. We've got stickers and a Smells Like Freedom candle, so check out our merch today at wethefreeshow.com. All right, look, I know what you're thinking. What happened to your mustache? Where were you last week? Why didn't your show drop on Thursday like usual? Okay, listen, I'll give you the answer to all of those questions at the end of the show today. And they are great surprises, just stick around to find out. And try not to be distracted by my baby face. All right. Now that I've at least begun to address these things, let's get to today's episode. It's the summer of 1858. There were 32 states in the Union with nearly 10 U.S. territories. A tall, slender senatorial candidate stands before the Illinois Republican National Convention, having just received their nomination. But this wasn't his first time on the political stage. Abraham Lincoln ran for the Illinois General Assembly in 1832, but failed. Then he succeeded in 1834. In 1836, he was admitted to the Illinois bar as a practicing lawyer. He ran for Congress in 1843, but lost the Whig Party nomination. Then he ran for the U.S. House in 1846 and won. He served one term and opposed the Mexican-American War and slavery's expansion. He resigned 2 years later, but ran for Senate again in 1854 with failure once again. 2 years after that, Lincoln attempted to run as vice president, but failed. Then on June 16th, 1858, something much more significant began to happen. Lincoln was selected for the newly reformed Republican Party's nomination to run for the U.S. Senate again, against the Democratic candidate, Stephen A. Douglas. In his acceptance speech, Lincoln would emphasize what would become the main political issue of the 19th century in America, slavery and the United States. His opponent, Stephen A. Douglas, was also no stranger to politics and the issue of slavery. He helped champion the Kansas-Nebraska Act of 1854, which repealed prior legislation which had once prohibited slavery in the Midwest territories. In other words, it legalized slavery in those areas by allowing settlers in Kansas and Nebraska to decide whether or not to allow slavery. You know, they were leaving it up to the states or territories to make their own decision on the issue. That wasn't the only legislation regarding slavery in the historical context of Lincoln's acceptance speech. The prior year included the infamous Dred Scott Supreme Court decision in 1857. Dred Scott was an enslaved African-American man who sued for his freedom. He was living in free territories, but was still enslaved, so he sued to be free. The court wrestled with three ideas. Was a black man entitled to sue in federal court? Did living in a free state or territory make him free? And did Congress have the authority to prohibit slavery in federal territories? Well, ultimately, the Supreme Court ruled 7-2 against Scott. in which they found, number one, African Americans are not citizens, and that black people were, quote, beings of an inferior order, end quote. Second, living in a free territory doesn't make you free. And number three, that the former slavery legislation, which was the Missouri Compromise, which banned slavery in federal territories, was unconstitutional. So this case effectively expanded slavery across the United States and territories. Stephen A. Douglas, being a Democrat, is fully supportive of this enslaving successes and lawfare. But Abraham Lincoln is the nominee for a new-ish coalition party known as the Republican Party. This party, founded just 4 years prior, or refounded, was a unification of three groups: the Whig Party, the Free Soil Party, and the Anti-Nebraska Movement. In other words, this new iteration of an older political party was formed on the basis of opposing slavery in America. Just to be clear, the Republican Party, which persists to today, was created to abolish and oppose the ownership of persons and unequal treatment of blacks in America. This is the setting for the Illinois RNC. Lincoln accepts his nomination with the following speech. "If we could first know where we are and whither we are tending, we could better judge what to do and how to do it. We are now far into the fifth year since a policy was initiated with the avowed object and confident promise of putting an end to slavery agitation. Under the operation of that policy, that agitation has not only not ceased, but is constantly augmented." Lincoln here is referring to the Kansas-Nebraska Act, which his opponent supported. "In my opinion, it will not cease until a crisis shall have been reached and passed." So let us remember, before we get into all of this, this very important idea. There is no progress without struggle. Lincoln's friend, Frederick Douglass, said something similar. The modern proverb today is no pain, no gain. But here, Lincoln is expressing that slavery will not be vanquished without serious confrontation. How prophetic, right? Next, Lincoln said, "A house divided against itself cannot stand. I believe this government cannot endure permanently half slave and half free. I do not expect the Union to be dissolved. I do not expect the House to fall, but I do expect it will cease to be divided. It will either become all one thing or all the other." He's continuing to prophesy the coming conflict. A house divided against itself cannot stand. It's impossible for us to be a national place, a government which espouses two opposing ideas, that of pro-slavery and abolitionist. A crisis is coming, and our union will become either all slave or all free. To illustrate this idea, Lincoln quoted the Son of God himself from Matthew chapter 12 and Mark chapter 3. Let's take a look at it. The context reveals that Jesus has recently healed a demon-possessed person. He's cast out a demon or demons. So Mark 3:22 begins by saying, "The scribes who came down from Jerusalem were saying, 'He is possessed by Beelzebul, and he casts out the demons by the ruler of the demons.'" So in the days of Jesus, Beelzebul was the name allotted to Satan, basically. However, it comes from all the way back in the Old Testament, the ancient Israeli days of pagans worshiping the false god, which the Hebrews and scriptures describe as Baal or Baal. In other words, the Jewish scribes were saying that Jesus was possessed by Satan. So what does Jesus say in response? "How can Satan cast out Satan? If a kingdom is divided against itself, that kingdom cannot stand. If a house is divided against itself, that house will not be able to stand. If Satan has risen up against himself and is divided, he cannot stand, but he is finished. Jesus' point is quite simple. How can I be possessed or controlled by Satan if I'm freeing one person after another from his deathly grip? That's like saying that Satan is opposing himself. Evil is divided against itself. Well, that's obviously ridiculous. He then illustrated the spiritual order with a short parable in verse 27. No one can enter the strong man's house and plunder his property unless he first binds the strong man, and then he will plunder his house. Who is the strong man? What or where is his house? What or who is his property? And who is the one plundering? Well, Satan is the strong man. His house is the kingdom of this world. Jesus has entered the house and has bound Satan by his work on the cross. And now he's plundering us out of Satan's house, one soul at a time. Why did Lincoln reference this scripture? He's likening the United States to a house which won't survive as long as the scourge of slavery exists. Just as a divided household, or as Jesus said, a kingdom, will collapse, Lincoln is warning in the beginning of his acceptance speech, the same will happen if slavery is not defeated. But as you'll see, this wasn't merely an issue of national unity. It was a moral issue. Lincoln expressed in this speech that America must resolve slavery once and for all, and that allowing it to exist in some states but not others is immoral and unsustainable. Lincoln also said, "Let any who doubts carefully contemplate that now almost complete legal combination, piece of machinery, so to speak, compounded of the Nebraska Doctrine and the Dred Scott decision. Let him consider not only what work the machinery is adapted to do and how well adapted, but also let him study the history of its construction and trace, if he can, or rather fail if he can, to trace the evidences of design and concert of action among its chief bosses from the beginning." All right, so Lincoln is saying there's something much more sinister coming when you consider the 1-2 punch of the Nebraska Doctrine and the Dred Scott case. Between the two of them, one permitted slavery under the guise of freedom, no doubt the oxymoron of the century, and the other denied the humanity and citizenship of blacks in America. The latter said it was unconstitutional to prohibit slavery. Lincoln says these two ingredients combine to concoct a deadly cocktail for the United States. Will we drink it or pour it down the drain? Well, Lincoln makes the case that this was their plan all along. Make it impossible to prohibit what was then the worst atrocity known to man. The core of the Kansas-Nebraska Act of 1854, what Lincoln refers to as the Nebraska Doctrine, was this idea of popular sovereignty, but is only applied to settlers, or what liberals today would call white people. It was based on both a misunderstanding of freedom, that you can do whatever you want, and a vehemently racist neglect of others brought to America or their descendants. Here's how Lincoln continues. "That if any one man choose to enslave another, no third man shall be allowed to object." That argument was incorporated into the Nebraska Bill itself in the language which follows. "It being the true intent and meaning of this act not to legislate slavery into any territory or state, nor to exclude it therefrom, but to leave the people thereof perfectly free to form and regulate their domestic institutions in their own way, subject only to the Constitution of the United States. Lincoln read from the actual legislation, and you can see how they fought to get it outside the Congress and leave it up to the people of those territories. They sought to neither exclude slavery or legalize it formally. But in doing so, Lincoln is arguing here, they intentionally promoted the scourge onward and outward. Next, he said, before the then next presidential election, the Law case came to and was argued in the Supreme Court of the United States, but the decision of it was deferred until after the election. Still, before the election, Senator Trumbull, on the floor of the Senate, requests the leading advocate of the Nebraska bill to state his opinion whether the people of a territory can constitutionally exclude slavery from their limits. And the latter answers, that is a question for the Supreme Court. Lincoln references the 1856 election between James Buchanan, Democrat, John Fremont, the Republican, and Millard Fillmore. This shows you how divisive the issue was. The president didn't want to touch it with a 10-foot pole. But Lincoln mentions Lyman Trumbull, who was a lawyer, an abolitionist, a judge, and a senator for Illinois. Trumbull forced the issue onto a floor discussion in the Senate chamber, and they deflected because they had to win an election. In other words, it was politically disadvantageous to talk about doing anything about slavery, both for and against it. Lincoln goes on to describe how nothing has progressed in its abolition. He further criticized the ideas of both the Nebraska Doctrine and the Dred Scott decision. His point in all this is to say that the Democrats have manufactured a machine which would establish slavery and further divide Americans. And again, he's saying all of this in his acceptance speech to the Illinois Republican National Convention to become their senator to defeat Stephen A. Douglas. And so then he says, this shows exactly where we are now, and partially also whither we are tending. It will throw additional light on the latter to go back and run the mind over the string of historical facts already stated. Several things will now appear less dark and mysterious than they did when they were transpiring. The people were to be left perfectly free, subject only to the Constitution. What the Constitution had to do with it, outsiders could not then see. Plainly enough now, it was an exactly fitted niche for the Dred Scott decision to afterward come in and declare that perfect freedom of the people to be just no freedom at all. How is it that legislators and justices interpreted the Nebraska Doctrine and the Dred Scott case so very incorrectly in the powerful light of the United States Constitution? The preamble emphasizes liberty and justice for all. It begins with the words, we, the people, and Article 5 created an opportunity for amendments, which we'll talk about in a moment. The words slave or slavery are nowhere in the original text. It also places the federal government in higher authority over the United States and gives Congress the power to regulate interstate commerce. So, what were they, evil or ignorant? Lincoln points out that the so-called freedom they assured was no freedom at all, as long as it was allowing some people to own other people. Now, here's how Lincoln finished this speech. To meet and overthrow the power of that dynasty is the work now before all those who would prevent that consummation. That is what we have to do. But how can we best do it? Our cause, then, must be entrusted to and conducted by its own undoubted friends, those whose hands are free, whose hearts are in the work, who do care for the result. 2 years ago, the Republicans of the nation mustered over 1,300,000 strong. We did this under the single impulse of resistance to a common danger with every external circumstance against us. Of strange, discordant, and even hostile elements, we gathered from the four winds and formed and fought the battle through under the constant hot fire of a disciplined, proud, and pampered enemy. Did we brave all then to falter now? Now, when that same enemy is wavering, dissevered, and belligerent? This result is not doubtful. We shall not fail if we stand firm. We shall not fail. Wise counsels may accelerate or mistakes delay it, but sooner or later the victory is sure to come. And so it was in June of 1858, Lincoln, nominated by the newly reformed Republican Party for Senate in Illinois, identified the problem, its source, and what would come of the nation if neglected. If you have time this weekend, you should look up the Lincoln-Douglas debates. The two candidates held seven debates across the state that put the modern debates of today to shame. The candidates gave speeches and rebuttals and answered questions from the audience. But after all this effort, Lincoln lost the race and was not elected to the Senate. 2 short years later, that same man, campaigning on the abolition of slavery, quoting Jesus Christ and rebuking the division in America, he became the president of the United States. It was November 6th, 1860. Abraham Lincoln was elected the 16th president of the United States. Then, nearly a month later, South Carolina becomes the first state to secede from the Union. 4 months later, on April 12, 1861, Fort Sumter in South Carolina was attacked by the Confederate Army, thus beginning the Civil War. So just to be clear, the Confederates' attack here was the official catalyst for the war's beginning. The House was divided against itself. The Union in the North sought to preserve the United States as a single, unified nation and largely oppose slavery, while the Confederacy in the South sought to preserve slavery and promote states' rights. The Union benefited from an industrialized economy with factories and railroads, while the Confederacy's economy was agricultural, relying on slave labor to produce their cash crops like cotton, tobacco, and sugar. The Union was more populated and therefore enjoyed greater representation in Congress, and they were led by Abraham Lincoln, while the Confederacy was formed by 11 seceding states under the leadership of Jefferson Davis. On July 21st, 1861, the Confederates claimed a significant victory at the First Battle of Bull Run in Virginia. This was the first full-scale battle of the Civil War, and the Union was outnumbered and suffered more casualties. Months later, the Union claimed victory at Fort Donelson and then at the Battle of Shiloh. The Confederates won the 7 days battles just when the Confederate capital was within reach of the Union Army, and the Confederacy were victorious again at the Second Battle of Bull Run, this time under the leadership of Robert E. Lee. However, in September of 1862, the Union won a significant victory in the bloodiest one-day battle at Antietam, or Sharpsburg. This victory gave President Lincoln the confidence to issue the following proclamation. Lincoln wrote the Emancipation Proclamation only 5 days after Antietam, only to take effect on January 1st, 1863. In part, it read, "All persons held as slaves within any state, or designated part of a state, the people whereof shall then be in rebellion against the United States, shall be then, thenceforward, and forever, free." This is a humongous opening line, earth-shattering. This is the President of the United States proclaiming that all the slaves in the Confederate States are free forever. This only applied to those 11 Confederate states, not all the Southern states. This was not only a moral victory, but a strategic move by the Union because it weakened the Confederacy. The proclamation also said, "The executive government of the United States, including the military and naval authority thereof, will recognize and maintain the freedom of such persons and will do no act or acts to repress such persons or any of them in any efforts they may make for their actual freedom." In other words, under the authority vested in Lincoln as the commander-in-chief, the United States military will protect these newly freed persons. He also said, "I further declare and make known that such persons of suitable condition will be received into the armed service of the United States to garrison forts, positions, stations, and other places, and to man vessels of all sorts in said service. And upon this act, sincerely believed to be an act of justice, warranted by the Constitution, upon military necessity, I invoke the considerate judgment of mankind and the gracious favor of Almighty God." Ladies and gentlemen, a majority of you have not become subscribers, or as we like to call them, freebies. There are two ways you can subscribe today. If you're listening on audio, head over to the show's homepage and click follow or subscribe. If you're watching the show, somewhere around this video, you'll see the subscribe button. Take a moment to press that button. Not only will this help us a great deal, it will guarantee your official status as a freebie, an expert in truth. Act now and become a freebie today. This proclamation served as the foundation for an amendment to the Constitution, which we'll come back to later. But in the spring of 1863, the Confederates won the Battle of Chancellorsville. The Union gained control of the Mississippi River after winning the Battle of Vicksburg, and perhaps most important of all, the Union won the Battle of Gettysburg. This was the big turning point. The loss spelled defeat for the Confederacy, and the battle itself was the bloodiest of all. Nearly 7,000 men died, 10,000 were missing or captured, and more than 33,000 were wounded on that Pennsylvania field. 4 months later, in November of 1863, President Lincoln delivered a speech there at the dedication of a national cemetery at Gettysburg. This is one of the most famous speeches in American history, and you'll see why, the Gettysburg Address. 47 years ago, our fathers brought forth on this continent a new nation conceived in liberty, and dedicated to the proposition that all men are created equal. America was conceived in liberty. And the proposition that Lincoln refers to, those founding words of freedom, liberty, and independence for all, it's nearly 100 years after the founders described the self-evident truth that all men are created equal, a proposition entirely attributable to Judeo-Christianity. The Bible teaches Imago Dei, that everyone, every person, is created, hello, in the image of God. Everyone is equal in that sense. Paul described the spiritual irrelevance of ancestry, skin color, status, or sex. Everyone, every person is equal in the eyes of God. The Bible shows us that Christ died for all. Proverbs 31 shows us that justice is to be equal, impartial, and unbiased. And I could go on and on. But some may object to say it's possible the founders were inspired by Judeo-Christianity, but they were mostly inspired by Enlightenment thinking and ancient Greek and Roman thought. To that, I would say, sure, the Enlightenment brought us concepts such as natural rights, but where do those come from? The Enlightenment thinker, John Locke, believed that natural law was a universal moral code inherent in the fabric of the universe, discoverable by reason. But he also wrote that humans are, quote, the workmanship of one omnipotent and infinitely wise maker, end quote. Now, he may not have recognized that infinitely wise maker as Yahweh, as was the case with Montesquieu and Rousseau, but they cannot deny a moral, purposeful, and benevolent creator. All of this was the basis of our founding. This was the foundation for eradicating slavery. So Lincoln says, "Now we are engaged in a great civil war, testing whether that nation, or any nation so conceived and so dedicated, can long endure. We are met on a great battlefield of that war. We have come to dedicate a portion of that field as a final resting place for those who here gave their lives that that nation might live. The brave men, living and dead, who struggled here have consecrated it far above our poor power to add or detract. The world will little note nor long remember what we say here, but it can never forget what they did here." For what were they fighting? Liberty and justice for all, everyone, every person. Lincoln was wrong about one thing, though. The world remembers both what was said there and what those casualties did there. This is how he closed this short yet powerful speech on the Civil War's bloodiest battlefield. "From these honored dead, we take increased devotion to that cause for which they gave the last full measure of devotion. That we here highly resolve that these dead shall not have died in vain, that this nation, under God, shall have a new birth of freedom, and that government of the people, by the people, for the people, shall not perish from the earth." Those men gave every ounce of themselves, literally, to the just cause of preserving liberty and democracy. What will we do to honor them so that they will not have died in vain? Well, Lincoln says, increased devotion. Did this call to unity and liberty work? This was in November of 1863. The fighting continued through the next year all over the southern states. But in the summer of 1864, Lincoln was re-nominated for president and won his re-election that November. Lincoln did not run as a Republican this time, though. Listen to this. Lincoln ran as a National Unionist, the party being the National Union Party, which was a coalition, a combining of forces of Republicans, Democrats, and Southerners who supported the Union. Lincoln defeated one of his own former generals, George McClellan, in the Electoral College that year, 212-21, and in the popular vote with 55%. This was a decisive victory for the United States, but also in the context of the war. On March 4th, 1865, Lincoln gave his second inaugural address. What does the righteous moral leader do in this situation? Gloat? Threaten? Or continue calling for peace, liberty, and unity? Let's see. On the occasion corresponding to this 4 years ago, all thoughts were anxiously directed to an impending civil war. All dreaded it. All sought to avert it. While the inaugural address was being delivered from this place, devoted altogether to saving the Union without war, insurgent agents were in the city seeking to destroy it without war, seeking to dissolve the Union and divide effects by negotiation. Both parties deprecated war, but one of them would make war rather than let the nation survive, and the other would accept war rather than let it perish. And the war came. One-eighth of the whole population were colored slaves, not distributed generally over the Union, but localized in the southern part of it. These slaves constituted a peculiar and powerful interest. All knew that this interest was somehow the cause of the war. Neither party expected for the war the magnitude or the duration, which it has already attained, neither anticipated that the cause of the conflict might cease with or even before the conflict itself should cease. Each looked for an easier triumph and a result less fundamental and astounding. Both read the same Bible and pray to the same God, and each invokes his aid against the other. It may seem strange that any men should dare to ask a just God's assistance in wringing their bread from the sweat of other men's faces, but let us judge not, that we be not judged. Now see, isn't that astounding? Lincoln says, both sides of this conflict were reading the same Bible and praying to the same God. How could they possibly come to such diametrically opposed beliefs on the central issue at hand? How could the house become so divided against itself? How can we interpret God's will so radically differently? How can people in the same house do such good and such evil? Lincoln's astonishment is expressed in his referencing Genesis 3:19, which says, "By the sweat of your face you will eat bread till you return to the ground." That was a part of the curse. How can these Confederate Christians dare to ask for God's help in getting their bread from the sweat of other men's faces, alluding to slavery? But that last line of his was very important. Regardless of this astounding thing, let us not judge. Again, he quotes Jesus to imply a humble call to reconciliation, unity, instead of condemnation. Let's think about that for a moment. Does that mean that we should tolerate evil? Does forgiveness and compassion look like tolerance? Of course, it does not. They are literally in the throes of the Civil War when he said this. They took up arms and sacrificed much to eradicate the scourge of slavery. I've been saying this for the last year and a half. Peace is achieved through victory. How could we say that differently? Peace is not achieved through tolerance and coexistence when the forces are diametrically opposed to each other. Peace is then achieved through the victory of one side and the loss of another. In the context of the Civil War, tolerance and coexistence and unity was impossible while one espoused slavery and the other did not. The only way for peace to exist was to fight it out and hope for goodness to prevail. Lincoln continued, "The prayers of both could not be answered. That of neither has been answered fully." It's easy for us in 2024 to look backwards into history and judge their decisions as if we would have done something different. However, one spiritual lesson here is that you and I can be reading our Bibles and praying to God and asking for His guidance and be fully convinced that we are doing the right thing, only to realize that we're completely wrong. And that what we're doing or the way that we're thinking is entirely unrighteous and unbiblical. But let's continue. The Almighty has His own purposes. "Woe unto the world because of offenses, for it must needs be that offenses come, but woe to that man by whom the offense cometh." If we shall suppose that American slavery is one of those offenses which in the providence of God must needs come, but which having continued through His appointed time, He now wills to remove, and that He gives to both North and South this terrible war as the woe due to those by whom the offense came, shall we discern therein any departure from those divine attributes which the believers in a living God always ascribe to him? Lincoln first implies that God has his own divine purpose in this conflict. Then he quotes Jesus again from Matthew 18 to say that slavery was inevitable in the fallen world, but that doesn't excuse those who perpetuated it or took advantage of that awful practice. He says that God has allowed it to exist in America for this long, but no longer. This civil war is his divine judgment against us all. Then he asks if this is uncharacteristic of God, but his answer is an implied no, of course not. God is righteous and merciful, wrathful and loving, holy and forgiving. So Lincoln continues, "Fondly do we hope, fervently do we pray, that this mighty scourge of war may speedily pass away. Yet if God wills that it continue until all the wealth piled by the bondsman's 250 years of unrequited toil shall be sunk, and until every drop of blood drawn with the lash shall be paid by another drawn with the sword, as was said 3,000 years ago, so still it must be said, the judgments of the Lord are true and righteous altogether." Notice that the president desperately wants the strife to end. But he says that God may not be done purging us of our sins. Not just in owning people and abusing people, but by financially profiting from it. Guilty blood must be shed for the innocent blood that was shed, the former being the profiteers and slave drivers, the latter being the slaves. Then Lincoln once again quotes scripture, this time from Psalm 19, to affirm that no matter how painful or prolonged the war may be, it is a just consequence for the nation's sin. And then Lincoln closes with some of his most famous words of all. "With malice toward none, with charity for all, with firmness in the right, as God gives us to see the right, let us strive on to finish the work we are in, to bind up the nation's wounds, to care for him who shall have borne the battle, and for his widow and his orphan, to do all which may achieve and cherish a just and lasting peace among ourselves and with all nations." In other words, let us come together. Let's heal. Let's help each other. And yet, without compromise. A month later, on April 9th, 1865, Confederate General Robert E. Lee surrendered to the Union General and future President Ulysses S. Grant in Virginia, effectively ending the Civil War. 5 days later, an anti-abolitionist, pro-slavery, Democrat sympathizer by the name of John Wilkes Booth assassinated President Lincoln by shooting him in the back of the head at Ford's Theater in Washington, D.C. He died that next day. The nation was reeling. The future was uncertain. Would the policy be reversed, all the policy from Lincoln's time? Would we war again? Are slaves still free? What does Reconstruction look like now? Is unity possible? Andrew Johnson, a Southern Democrat, was Lincoln's vice president as part of the National Union Party. He became the president by default. That December, Congress ratified the 13th Amendment, officially and legally abolishing slavery in the United States of America. Despite this great thing happening, the country and the federal government were in shambles after the war. Andrew Johnson became the first president to face impeachment for obstructing Reconstruction efforts, which they classified as high crimes and misdemeanors. But he was narrowly acquitted by the Senate, like by one vote. So he served the rest of his term. One other significant legislative event was the ratification of the 14th Amendment on July 9th, 1868. Let's consider two of the sections from that amendment, written during the Reconstruction period, for that purpose. One that you've heard numerous times since January of 2021 is Section 3 of the 14th Amendment, which deals with insurrection. Okay, now that you know the context for that amendment, let's read it together. No person shall be a senator or representative in Congress, or elector of president and vice president, or hold any office, civil or military, under the United States, or under any state, who, having previously taken an oath as a member of Congress, or as an officer of the United States, or as a member of any state legislature, or as an executive or judicial officer of any state, to support the Constitution of the United States, shall have engaged in insurrection or rebellion against the same, or given aid or comfort to the enemies thereof. First of all, the positions of president and vice president are excluded from this amendment. But more importantly, the purpose of this section of the amendment was to root out Confederate sympathizers from the federal government. Specifically, if you had served in the U.S. government prior to the war or state governments, but then you fought for the Confederacy, that was insurrectionist. Now, the main section of this amendment that I want to talk about is Section 1. There are four clauses in Section 1 of the 14th Amendment. The Citizenship Clause is first. It reads, "All persons born or naturalized in the United States and subject to the jurisdiction thereof are citizens of the United States and of the state wherein they reside." This clause defined U.S. citizenship and overturned the Dred Scott decision, making blacks, former slaves, and their families Americans. Now, you can see that they're not only citizens of their country, they're also citizens of their state. Well, that could present some problems legally. So that brings us to the Immunities Clause. No state shall make or enforce any law which shall abridge the privileges or immunities of citizens of the United States. Simply put, the federal government is superior to state governments, and national laws are superior to state laws, and the latter cannot contradict the former. A state cannot deprive you your rights as an American citizen, which would include the laws that we're reading right now. That brings us to clause number 3. The Due Process Clause. It reads, "Nor shall any state deprive any person of life, liberty, or property without due process of law." Again, as simply as I can explain it, in similar fashion to the Fifth Amendment, the Due Process Clause extends these restrictions to the states, that no government, federal or state, can deprive you of your life, your liberty, or your property without fair procedures, trials, hearings, etc. And I view this clause as a partner to the final one, the Equal Protection Clause, which says, "Nor deny to any person within its jurisdiction, the equal protection of the laws." The context of this amendment was slavery and the Civil War. So in its immediate purpose, the amendment served to grant blacks citizenship in America, nationally protective rights, and equal protection and treatment under the law. In modernity, this amendment, and specifically the Due Process and Equal Protections clauses, has been used to rubber stamp abortion and same-sex marriage in cases like Roe v. Wade and Obergefell v. Hodges. But why was Roe v. Wade just overturned? The justices in 1973 created a fictional right to privacy privacy, which is not constitutional. Life, liberty, and property do not entail that you may do whatever you want in quote-unquote privacy. All sorts of lawless evil deeds are committed in the dark, in the shadows. In fact, most of them are committed privately. Liberty, as understood by the founders and Jews and Christians for millennia, does not mean that you can do whatever you want to do. We have laws and rules and regulations to preserve liberty, not to stifle it. And there's also no such thing as a right to an abortion. The founders and the framers would have been absolutely repulsed by such a suggestion. And just as Lincoln was astonished at the contradiction of Confederate Christians, the 14th Amendment, in my opinion, protects the lives and liberty and provides equal protection to the unborn. The next time abortion finds itself in the Supreme Court, and it will, the justices will have to determine what a person is. You know, I approached all this historic material looking for answers in healing our national divide. We're the most divided we've been since the Civil War era in the 19th century. Slavery was the morally and politically divisive issue of their day. But what is it that divides us now? Is it as morally reprehensible as slavery? Will it take a war to defeat it? Whatever it is. I'm sure we could list many things like religious freedom, marriage, sexual ethics, gender identity. The key issue of our day, though, by a long shot, is abortion. And as I was studying the Civil War and Lincoln's speeches, it was shocking the similarities between the two issues of slavery and abortion. The abolitionists recognized the life and personhood of the black person and the unborn child, while the opposition does not. Slavery was the most divisive issue of its time. Abortion is the most divisive issue of our time. The same party who fought to preserve slavery is the same party fighting to preserve abortion today, the Democratic Party. Lincoln pointed out that the stepping stone to nationalizing slavery was the legislation to leave it up to the states, just as what's happened with abortion today. Speaking of that legislation, slavery was permitted under the guise of freedom, only at the expense of black freedom. Abortion is protected under the guise of freedom as well, only at the expense of the child. Politicians didn't want to touch slavery until one finally came along who did. Politicians today don't want to touch abortion, and we're still waiting for somebody who will. The 14th Amendment was created to give blacks citizenship, due process, and equal protection, but the same amendment was used a century later to strip due process, equal protection, and even the chance of citizenship, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness to the baby. Ironically, abortion affects black babies more than any other race. 40% of abortions in America are the killing of innocent little black children. The sick and twisted irony in that fact is that Margaret Sanger, the founder of Planned Parenthood, was a racist eugenicist. Eugenics is the practice of controlled selective breeding of human populations, as by sterilization, to improve the population's genetic composition. Margaret Sanger wanted to eliminate blacks from the American population. That's what eugenics is. She specifically placed clinics, Planned Parenthood, in urban, impoverished areas. And that's still the case today. Look it up. She supported the Negro Project of 1939, which was designed to bring birth control to African Americans in the South. On that note, she wrote this letter to black clergymen in the South. Quote, "We do not want word to go out that we want to exterminate the Negro population. And the minister is the man who can straighten out that idea if it ever occurs to any of their more rebellious members." Around that same time, she also said, "Birth control is nothing more or less than the facilitation of the process of weeding out the unfit, of preventing the birth of defectives, or of those who will become defectives." Listen to the dehumanizing language, which sounds strikingly similar to the language used to describe slaves long ago. That is the foremost issue of our time. But it's not the singular issue, which constitutes for us our house divided. While whole states differ on the issue and legislate differently on the issue, the half that's for it is not about to take up arms to wage war against the side who's against it. You and I know that all these issues come from the same place and can be deduced to a single word: sin. Sin is the reason for all our problems. It's the reason for slavery. It's the reason for war. It's the fuel behind abortion and/or murder. It's the cause of gender confusion and marital distortion. It's humanity's source of pain, struggle, and division from the very beginning. It's the reason why two groups who both identify as Christian can read the same book and pray to the same God and come to completely opposite conclusions as to what's right and wrong, good and evil, moral and immoral. This is why our house is divided. And I'm not only talking about America's house. I'm talking about God's house in America, the church, and I'm talking about the house within ourselves, the dwelling place for the Spirit of God. Within these three houses, there is great division. And the cause for this division is sin. It starts with the sin in my house, which extends into the house of God, which extends to the house of America. We are houses divided. What is the war that we must wage to restore our houses to goodness and peace? Well, we have to eradicate the sin within. Let's start with ourselves. In Romans 7, 22 through 23, Paul wrote, "For I joyfully concur with the law of God in the inner man, but I see a different law in the members of my body, waging war against the law of my mind and making me a prisoner of the law of sin, which is in my members." Jesus likened sin to slavery in John 8, 34 and 36, saying, "Truly, truly, I say to you, everyone who commits sin is the slave of sin. If the Son makes you free, you will be free indeed." Paul describes the two sides of the personal spiritual war waging within us with some tactical strategy in Galatians 5, 16 through 17, saying, "Walk by the Spirit. Walk by the Spirit, and you will not carry out the desire of the flesh. For the flesh sets its desire against the Spirit, and the Spirit against the flesh, for these are in opposition to one another, so that you may not do the things that you please." Our next divided house is the American house of God, the church. How are we to wage war against sin there? Well, there's certainly an expectation, a higher responsibility on the shepherd and his given flock to lead them to green pastures and still waters, to use the word of God consistently and faithfully in teaching, reproof, correction, and training in righteousness, as we see in 2 Timothy 3:16. But with the church, in the broader sense, there is a plethora of scripture commanding us to love each other by addressing sin, not by neglect or ignoring it or tolerating it In Galatians 6, 1 through 2, Paul says, "If anyone is caught in any trespass, you who are spiritual, restore such a one in a spirit of gentleness, each one looking to yourself so that you too will not be tempted. Bear one another's burdens and thereby fulfill the law of Christ." That then carries us perfectly into the final house, the one which Lincoln called divided. How do we wage war against sin and evil there? Well, if we've done the first two battles appropriately, our war is fought in the world by our works and words and testimony. What did Jesus do? John 3:17 talks about his mission. God sent him into the world, not for condemnation, but for salvation, to seek and save the lost. A proclamation of the gospel is an essential tactic in this cultural war. The Apostle Paul asked, "How then will they call on him in whom they have not believed? How will they believe in him whom they have not heard? And how will they hear without a preacher?" And that doesn't mean pastors and clergy. The Greek there, keruso, means to proclaim. That means all of us. The word there is actually a verb, not a noun. So it's better translated as preaching, not preacher. Every week on this show, I reference the similitudes in Matthew chapter 5. Jesus says we're to be the salt of the earth and the light of the world. We're supposed to make life taste better and last. We're supposed to shine in the darkness. And according to Jesus, when we do that, the lost will see your good works and glorify your Father who is in heaven. They get to know God, or start to know God, through you. We're to tell people the truth, which will set them free in a manner which is loving. We're to realize that though we walk in the flesh, we do not war according to the flesh. For the weapons of our warfare are not of the flesh. They're not physical weapons, but divinely powerful for the destruction of fortresses. We are destroying speculations and every lofty thing raised up against the knowledge of God, and we are taking every thought captive to the obedience of Christ. The Bible describes itself as the only weapon in our arsenal, the Word of God. Therefore, in light of that last passage, we are to combat ideas and ideologies which are raised up against the knowledge of God, false prophecy, beliefs, evil world systems and ideas, wicked political ideologies, agendas, etc., to destroy those fortresses of Satan's kingdom and take every thought captive to Christ. Now, before we go today, I've got two surprises for you. First of all, why is the mustache gone? Well, 8 years ago, I wrote a musical with our worship pastor, and we're performing that musical on December 14th and 15th. It's called No Greater Love, which is a story from World War II. It's set in 1944 around Christmas time. George and Johnny are two soldiers that are looking for hope in the midst of all the battle. The musical features a 1940s style music, a radio hall, and George's family back home in Louisville. We posted this teaser on Veterans Day. Check it out.
It's been a long time. I want you to know that I'm still hanging in there. We miss you. It's hard to think about you leaving, but it's comforting to remember the good times we shared. The laughs, the serious moments. Remembering some of the things you said. You were our rock, our anchor. You always kept us on course. Lord knows I couldn't have made it this far without you. I'd be lost without you. And there's not a doubt in my mind. The world would be far, far worse if it had not been for you and your sacrifice on God's green earth. You know, it's amazing. After all these years, I still find it hard to express the love and gratitude I have for you and the love that you showed to me. Greater love hath no man than this, that a man lay down his life for his friends. That's what the good book says. That's what you did for me on that awful, unforgettable day. I'll never forget your sacrifice, and I still talk about it to so many that I know today. Your actions were emblematic of Christ's love. But for now, let me say, until we meet again, old friend, so long. I'll pay you back someday.
If you want more information, go to CorrytonChurch.com. That's CorryTonChurch.com. And finally, I'm late this week in part because of the musical, but also because my wife, Kate, is expecting our third child. She's 20 weeks this week. We're having another boy. We got three boys now. His name is Matthew Reed Watson. Her pregnancy has been tough this time, but she's doing much better now. We're excited to welcome another boy into the world, so we cherish your prayers at this time, and thanks for your patience this season. But that's going to do it for me today. I hope you have a great and happy and gratitude-filled Thanksgiving. I will have a special Thanksgiving episode for you all on Thanksgiving morning, so I'll be back live on December 5th. And we'll have a lot to talk about then. For now, go and be that salt and light you are meant to be, and we'll see you next time on We the Free. We the Free is written and produced by Blake Watson in East Tennessee. Special thanks to the Freebies, our supporters, for your feedback, prayers, and financial support. For inquiries, contact Blake at WeTheFreeShow.com. Read more about We the Free at WeTheFreeShow.com and check out our merch store there. You can also subscribe to our YouTube channel and watch all the content you've heard today on video.